Hey gang, before the episode, just want to let you know, over at the Intensive Care Academy, our other project where we provide video-based lessons on all kinds of critical care topics, continuing education credits available, over, 50 hours of some good stuff. We are running a sale for the month of April 2026. If you want 20% off new subscriptions, go and register with the code APR26. APR26, it'll give you your discount. It'll last until the end of April 2026. Hope to see you there. Otherwise, on to the episode. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. It is Brandon here, back with Brian.
Hello, everyone.
And we're going to talk about some late-breaking news right off the presses. We have a new set of guidelines from the Surviving Sepsis campaign. This is one of the most sort of widely encountered guidelines that most people come across in fields like critical care and emergency medicine, anyone who takes care of sick patients, because sepsis is like everybody has sepsis. And guidelines are, you know, have a larger or smaller role in your practice depending on some variables. But this one has really touched a lot of people. So updates are always of relevance. It's in collaboration with SCCM as well as, I think, the ESICM in Europe. And we have with us here Hallie Prescott, who was the co-chair of the writing committee. She's a professor of pulmonary and critical care at University of Michigan, an intensivist. And she's going to try to give us a little bit of insight into what's new, why the guidelines are written as they are. And to be totally frank, there's been some controversy about the guidelines. So we're going to try to understand a little bit about, you know, how they come to pass. Most people who read these, of course, don't ever write such things. So a little bit of a glimpse behind the curtain, I think, will be helpful. But welcome, Hallie.
Thanks for having me.
So yeah, so Brandon mentioned this is hot off the presses. As of today we're recording, this was presented at the Society of Critical Care Medicine Congress in Chicago 2 days ago, I believe. So yeah, this is late-breaking stuff. Thanks for coming on. The session you guys did at Congress I thought was really good. It was interesting. I noticed that we didn't have time for questions and discussion. I'm not sure if that was by design or not, like Brandon hinted at, that this can be a heated topic. But I wanted to start out with, before we get into controversy and get into, because I do want to get into the guideline process. Those of people, Brandon, have you ever been on a guideline? You've been on a guideline committee, right?
We did a consensus thing, but not a formal guideline.
Yeah. So I've been involved in a couple, and it's an interesting process for those people who haven't been involved. And a lot of times when you come out with guideline statements, people get kind of fired up about things.
And people don't like being told what to do.
Yeah, and a lot of times those statements are somewhat a casualty of the guideline process. And we can kind of get into that a little bit more. But let's start just with a basic overview of Surviving Sepsis campaign guidelines and what's new in this update as opposed to the previous ones. So just kind of walk us through, like, what's different?
Yeah, sure. So these are, you know, quite comprehensive guidelines. There are 129 recommendations this time. So there's a lot of material in there, but I'll try to hit the high points of what I think are sort of maybe the most important new recommendations. So we have new conditional recommendations to screen for sepsis en route to hospital. So that would be like in ambulance or in flight. And again, you know, that's really just trying to move up the time to diagnosis. You know, I would say over the past like many decades, like an overarching theme is the faster you recognize and the faster you treat sepsis, the better. So that is a new suggestion. The second is a new suggestion to initiate antimicrobial therapy in ambulance or flight en route to hospital, but that's a very targeted recommendation, right? So it's not for all patients. That's for patients who have probable sepsis, they're hypotensive, and they have a prolonged transport time such that they're not anticipated to be evaluated in hospital for over an hour. So that's a new, I would say, important recommendation. Other new ones, we have new conditional recommendations related to anti-anaerobic coverage and trying to essentially minimize or avoid that for sites of infection where it's very unlikely that there's going to be an anaerobic infection. And that relates to, like, you know, not prescribing specific antibiotics to cover anaerobes, but also being mindful of the spectrum of coverage, you know, of other antibiotics that maybe, you know, were picked for gram-negative coverage, but, you know, come part and parcel with anaerobic coverage. So those are important ones. And then I would say maybe the third would be for blood pressure targets. Before, there was a recommendation for just over 65 across the board. And so there's a new conditional recommendation that for older patients ages 65 and up, targeting a range of 60 to 65 for initial mean arterial target in patients with septic shock.
I wanted to ask about the antibiotics for a second, because this is something that I, during the presentation, you guys kind of mentioned, and specifically addressed things like metronidazole being added, which I know that's sort of a common kind of empiric therapy is sort of vanc, cefepime, metronidazole, especially in, you know, surgical patients, especially, you know, gram negative and anaerobic coverage in the gut for surgical patients.
Yes. Yeah. So I will say that there are two recommendations, right? A conditional recommendation for and a conditional recommendation against, depending on whether your patient is higher or lower risk. So certainly intra-abdominal infection would be a reason to include anaerobic coverage, but sites of infection where there's going to be a very low risk would be pneumonia and urinary infection. And there's a lot of patients that, despite having a site of infection that's known and not at high risk for an anaerobic infection, still get that, right? Like, people will add on, oh, because it's aspiration, but it is not necessary.
Mm-hmm. So while I get the sort of, we don't need to add metronidazole, you know, one of my go-to, even in intra-abdominal sepsis, my go-to mm-hmm. regimen prophylactically is vancomycin and piptazo.
Yes.
And piptazo has a pretty decent anaerobic coverage as well, which
sure.
is why I don't use Flagyl. So let's say I'm treating just pneumonia. That's my suspected source. Is the recommendation now sort of to veer away from piptazo to maybe something like cefepime or something that has less
correct.
You know, anaerobe coverage?
Correct. Yes. And I think, you know, again, there's a lot of factors that go into selecting antibiotic therapy. And so, you know, ideally, you have a hospital antibiogram that tells you your, you know, susceptibilities to different antibiotics generally that are being seen in your hospital. And so obviously you have to be mindful of that too. But, like, kind of all things being equal and either of these being a reasonable choice, this would say, you know, take into account the spectrum of coverage and where you can, you know, avoid the anaerobic coverage, which would then be, like you say, choosing cefepime over piptazo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So again, I mean, it's a conditional recommendation. So that means that it's context dependent by definition. So I think that's one of the things in terms of, like, guideline methodology is that, I mean, I didn't really, I think, fully appreciate this until I was involved in guidelines, is that recommendations are strong, which means, like, kind of like do this for all or most all patients, or conditional, which means, like, this is like the default practice. This is the rule of thumb. This is a great starting point, but there may be important reasons for deviating or varying from that based on the clinical context. So mm-hmm. All this to say, there are multiple factors that go into selecting your antibiotic regimen, but there's also lots of scenarios where, like, the guidelines would say either cefepime or piptazo are reasonable. And this is saying, well, if these are reasonable and you can do narrower, do it. Because I think we're increasingly recognized that there's sort of collateral damage that comes along from anti-anaerobic coverage and suppressing healthy gut microbiome and, you know, risk for secondary infection, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So is that the main reason? I mean, so I guess if I'm taking this from a standpoint of, if I'm a clinician and,
yes.
and I say, well, okay, it makes sense to me if I can use two drugs instead of three drugs, I should just not add the metronidazole.
Sure. Yes.
But, you know, I sort of have my brain on autopilot with my vancomycin.
Yes.
Do I really need to think hard about should I do zosyn or should I do cefepime? Is that basically the rationale, is that you don't need the piptazo is a bigger gun than you need for this, and it's going to suppress gut microbiome?
Correct. Yes. So we have good evidence that, right, this leads to changes in the density and composition of the microbiome. And, you know, that is associated with worse longer-term outcomes like 90-day mortality.
The other thing that stood out at me in particular was this recommendation for pre-hospital antibiotics, which is, on a conceptual sense, like you said, makes sense, just giving antibiotics earlier, but pretty different from current practice. You know, of course, many EMS systems give drugs in the field, but I don't think I've ever seen antibiotics used. I'm curious if you have an idea what that would look like. Obviously, EMS crews would have to screen for what they thought was sepsis, but for giving, I'm not sure what antibiotic you would have in mind. And then you say, you know, do this if you think it'll be more than 60 minutes until you can get there. So this, you know, doesn't apply to a lot of urban systems, but those Correct. That might have a very long transport time. But I mean, what would you see as a practical workflow for doing this?
Yeah. So, right. There is a remark, with the recommendation that this is something that should be implemented only after the screening is in place. So I do think that the first step is to implement screening for sepsis, kind of iron out the kinks of that. And then also, as you mentioned, this is really not necessarily something that's going to be across the board, but really for regions where there's prolonged transport time to the hospital. So I can imagine, I mean, so there, you know, there's like actually ongoing clinical trials, right, where the pit stop trial in Canada, where they are randomizing people, for example, to IM ceftriaxone. So we will get more data, you know, hopefully when that comes out, but that's like, you know, how it's been implemented, at least in a clinical trial type standpoint.
Do you foresee that could have some downstream negative effects, like mm-hmm. increased antibiotic use, more difficulty obtaining cultures? Of course, we try to get cultures yeah. before antibiotics in the hospital, not always easy, but in this case, it would be impossible.
And that's why it's like such a narrow recommendation, right? Like this isn't even all patients with prolonged transport time. It's patients who are hypotensive, right? So, you know, at least in Michigan, in our sepsis registry, that's about 20% of patients who present with community onset sepsis are hypotensive. So this is a minority, right? So this is really meant to be targeted. And so, yeah, I mean, if we recommended this across the board, of course, you know, then the balance of like benefits and harms, you know, maybe tipped elsewhere. But we're really trying to pick out, well, gosh, these are like the critically ill patients. They're already hypotensive. We don't think they're going to be seen by anyone for like over an hour, you know, trying to sort of intervene sooner on those patients. So, you know, for all of our recommendations, we go through this thing called the evidence to decision framework, where we think about like, well, what are the balance, like what are the sort of benefits, you know, what are the potential harms, what are the balance of those two things, you know, how does this impact equity, what is the sort of cost effectiveness, you know, feasibility and acceptability. So like only after considering all of those things do we then move on and sort of make a draft recommendation that then gets kind of circulated for feedback and ultimately voted on. So I mean, exactly, a lot of the things that you're bringing up are things that we sort of discussed on the panel, and a lot of what we, you know, we iterated on this kind of exact statement. We wanted to make it crystal clear that this is a narrow targeted recommendation and not to be misconstrued as, oh gosh, you know, now they're saying everybody in the ambulance needs antibiotics. Like that's definitely not the intended message. Mm-hmm. And then also something that came through in the course of revisions was that remark about you don't just want to go off implementing this until you sort of have a system in place to screen for sepsis in the ambulance.
I'm curious also about selective decontamination of the digestive tract.
Yes.
SDD, which is a practice that's been talked about in the literature for some time, but I've really never seen anywhere that widely was using it. It's kind of been this niche idea. Do you want to just give us like a sentence description for what that actually entails and why it was recommended here, which is, I think, the strongest recommendation for it that I've seen in the critical care realm?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so selective or SDD is essentially an approach that involves giving empiric antibiotics two patients in intensive care unit who are mechanically ventilated. So again, critically ill and mechanically ventilated. And so these are the types of patients that are at risk for hospital-acquired infections like ventilator-associated pneumonia. And so this involves topical antimicrobials, oral antimicrobials, and then IV. But these are very sort of carefully selected to try to be narrow spectrum such that they are targeting gram negatives and not this kind of healthy anaerobe. So the idea is to sort of prevent the development of secondary hospital onset infections, but, you know, essentially be quite selective in terms of what that approach is. And so it's certainly, I would say, used more in Europe, and not aware that really it's being used in the US, but it is one of these things that we have extensive clinical trial data on. When we think about sort of prioritizing questions for the Surviving Sepsis Campaign guidelines, or really probably for any guidelines, like, I don't think it sort of helps move the field forward to just keep answering the same questions over and over again. Do you know what I mean? And so the idea was to try to address kind of new questions that haven't been addressed. And also, like, you also want to, address questions for which, like, there may be some evidence that's worth reviewing, right? Like, if we sort of ask all these questions, but we sort of know as an expert panel that, like, there's no data, you know, it's not super helpful to have a guideline full of, like, well, statement of insufficient evidence to make a recommendation. I mean, kind of helpful to prioritize future research, but, you know, quite unsatisfying from a, you know, end user clinician to have a guideline like that, right? So, you know, there's lots and lots and lots of clinical trials that have been done on this exact topic.
I guess that kind of leads us to one of the broader questions that came to mind, and I think is in the mind of some people, which is what's the intention of a guideline like this? Because one of the themes that came to mind as I skimmed through it was that many of the recommendations are either fairly weak. You know, you suggest doing some things mm-hmm. that are probably a good practice, or you make no recommendation. There wasn't data for that. Or they're obvious. I mean, they're what I would call standard of care, critical care sorts of things. You know, keep them this normal, do that. Stuff that really is obvious. I mean, it's like the old joke for journal clubs. Every article is either obvious or you disagree with it. So it does make me wonder what you imagine as the successful impact of a document like this would be. And I guess one answer that comes to mind is it's not for me. It's for people who are not specialists mm-hmm. and is trying to establish kind of a floor of just general good practices for them. For them, it might be, some of these things might be more surprising. But I don't know. I mean, what would you imagine as, like, in a year or two, you're like, oh, we really did what we hoped to achieve with that document?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, medicine is vast, right? There are lots of topics. When you're in the emergency department, when you're in the ICU, you see patients with all sorts of problems. Like, it's not feasible for everybody to know the literature for every single thing inside and out. And then also we have, you know, new trainees and new people joining the field. Like, so for me, I think you're right. I mean, it's most helpful for people who probably have less experience. And, you know, there's lots of things for me that, like, I don't follow the primary literature on. So I'm happy to go, you know, just refresh my mind about guidelines for, like, management of pulmonary embolism or all these kind of things, just because it's not feasible to stay, you know, up to date in the weeds on every single topic there is. So I think that this provides very helpful kind of, like, summarization of kind of where things stand. And obviously, the more close you are to the topic, the more you know it, the more you're like, well, yeah, I already knew that, you know. But I don't think that means it's not helpful for the field at large.
Yeah, and I think maybe this is one of the sources of controversy, I guess, is that how people interpret guidelines.
Yes,
right?
Correct.
And I run into this a lot with students and with novice practitioners and even experienced practitioners, right, who say, well, we have to do this because that's what the guidelines say. And, you know, I always push back a little bit and say, well, that's why they're called guidelines and not commandments or, you know, laws or whatever.
Correct.
I guess let's dive in a little bit to the guideline process as well, because I know one of the things that often comes out of these things is, like you said, we can't make a recommendation. And that doesn't mean that there's no evidence out there. It just means that to be included in a guideline, we have very strict standards. And if it doesn't rise to those strict standards, sometimes you can't make a recommendation. Can you just sort of, for folks who don't understand this process, kind of give us the quick overview of how you assess the literature, how do you review the studies, how you decide what to do, how this all works?
I'll try to give the guideline methods in a nutshell. Yeah. So I would say the first step is that we prioritize questions. So the guidelines are divided into 6 working groups, and those are based on different topical areas. So there's like screening and early management, infection, hemodynamic resuscitation, additional and adjunctive therapies, respiratory management, and then a group that does like goals of care, transitions of care, long-term outcomes. So within those working groups, they essentially develop questions. And so typically that will start with, well, you review the questions from the prior guideline and decide if we want to address those again. But you also brainstorm about like, what are other important questions, you know, that we haven't addressed that, you know, we think would be important to include. And then after all these questions have been brainstormed, we do a prioritization process. So people score those, and then the top scoring ones essentially get moved forward. And then, so we had 60 questions that were selected across these 6 groups. And the questions that are selected, they get put into this PICO format. So we define the patient population for whom we're talking about. We define the intervention and like what search terms would you do to go do a literature search on that as compared to what. So you can do this intervention or nothing, or you're going to do this intervention or this alternative intervention, and then the outcomes. And so the outcomes is an important part because we pre-specify those. So for each different question, we select probably around 7 outcomes that we think like, well, these are the most important things. And this prevents you being like duped, I think, from, you know, okay, there's some like obscure tertiary outcome that was statistically significant, but this is kind of making you call your shots in advance, right? Saying we only really want to know if this intervention includes these outcomes. And then we do have like a patient and family advisory panel that also reviewed those outcomes. And so that basically makes the specifications for the literature search. Like we've defined the terms that this intervention might be called. We've defined the specific outcomes that will be abstracted from the literature. So then a research librarian developed the search, you know, in close collaboration with the experts and commenced on a literature search. And, you know, there's iterative feedback back and forth to make sure like, you know, key articles that we know exist are being found, et cetera, et cetera. So after that, data is abstracted. And again, we only extract the data from these studies that's been pre-specified. So we're only pulling the outcomes that we've sort of prioritized ahead of time. So like you say, sometimes there's evidence, but it's like on an outcome that like isn't clinically meaningful, right, to patients or clinicians. So we're not going to abstract that data. That data is not going to factor into our decision making. So then we have the kind of like an evidence synthesis that for each of those outcomes, we have like the number of studies. Well, 2 studies had short-term mortality. Okay, 3 studies had long-term mortality. You know, 3 studies had ventilator-free days or, you know, whatever the outcomes are. And so we have like the number of patients, the number of trials, like the effect size, you know, estimated number of, you know, additional people per 1,000, you know, that would have or not have this event. So we have a standardized way to review the evidence. And then we go through that evidence to decision framework I mentioned, where we talk about the, you know, benefit, magnitude of benefit, like sort of harm. So sometimes we have some outcomes go one way and some go the other way. And then we try to make an assessment of, well, what do we think is the overall balance of effects across these outcomes? And then again, we sort of go through this structured process where we think about the cost. A lot of times there's not data on that. So it's more of kind of like based on our experience, what we would anticipate. And then we think about cost effectiveness, like implications for equity, feasibility, and acceptability. And so after that, we then develop the draft statements. And typically, you know, this kind of falls, you know, kind of on a scale of strong recommendation for, you know, conditional, or weak recommendation for, you know, recommendation against or strong recommendation against. And so, you know, typically, you know, the process of the literature searches, I will say that we always prioritize the best quality evidence first. So that means if there's multiple randomized clinical trials on a topic, we really don't go down to observational literature. But if there's, you know, very few or low quality or no randomized clinical trials, then we're going to go to high quality observational studies. Essentially, like you're trying to find whatever the best available highest quality data is to answer a given question. And so for a certain question where there's lots of randomized clinical trials, you stop there. For other studies, you're going to go to other types of literature. And then wherever possible, if there already is a high quality systematic review and meta-analysis, we'll start there and then maybe add additional studies that have been published since that was completed. So, I mean, there's a pretty, I would say, structured and rigorous process to going about the evidence search. And then it's the subgroup, the clinical experts in the subgroup that make this determination of for any given question, kind of what counts. Like, are you only going to focus on randomized clinical trials? And then, okay, so our target population is sepsis. We only have a trial in COVID, that would get sort of downgraded as sort of indirect evidence, for example. So depending on how close the target population is to the target population of the question. And so, I mean, at the end of the day, I think we had 11 statements of insufficient evidence out of 129. So it definitely happens. But wherever possible, we try, if there is evidence, we do try to make a statement. And that's why you end up with a lot of conditional recommendations. You don't want to make strong recommendations when there's limited data. And then new this time, I would say, is we included a lot of these in our practice statements, which was just a panel survey. What do you do in your practice in these different scenarios? And we try to be very transparent that those are not recommendations, but we know how unsatisfying it is to read statements of insufficient evidence. So this provides just some idea, to the field about what the panel is doing.
I think part of the, I was just over on Twitter, and we invited questions to bring up today, and there was a lot of heat. A lot of people were real mad about this these guidelines, and reading between the lines, because a lot of guidelines you can agree with or disagree with, but people don't usually care. The reason people seem to be so emotional about this one is because I think the surviving sepsis guidelines, more than maybe any other, have reached out to have downstream impacts on how care is provided and regulated. And more than anything, this applies in the emergency department, probably. And where some of these metrics have been adopted as quality measures used by institutions like Medicare to pertain to reimbursement, people have really been asking questions like, well, the guidelines say that you should give all these patients 30 cc per kilo bolus of fluid in a certain amount of time. If you haven't done that, you gave bad care and we should take away some money or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's been done pretty widely, specifically for sepsis. Mm-hmm. And so I think what a lot of people were probably hoping is that the updated guideline would say less about some of those topics, meaning basically decline to recommend some of these practices that I think a lot of people feel like, not that they're universally bad, they're not saying no one should get fluid or have antibiotics given on certain timelines or things like that, but making clear recommendations for amounts or time cutoffs is applied by regulatory institutions and bodies and persons in ways that are sort of at best heavy-handed and at worst, I think at least some people feel harmful. Mm-hmm. And most recently, the news was just that ACEP, the emergency physicians, have declined to endorse the new guidelines, I think because of probably some of these disagreements. So I guess I'm curious your take on all this. I mean, on one hand, there's a guideline process. You issue the guideline. People can kind of do what they want with it. But do you feel like there is a, I guess, do you have any thought to a sort of responsibility for how it's applied, or a feeling that it could be have downstream impacts that that could be negative, or perhaps you feel like those are part of the desired goal for a document like this?
Yeah. So I think that, first of all, it's important to recognize that this is really intended to be a global guideline, right? So this is funded by Society of Critical Care Medicine in the US, but also, 50% by ESICM. So even from the get-go, this has, joint funding from outside of the US. And then we have panelists from 23 countries, and the bulk of sepsis in the world, happens in low resource settings. So when we think about the impact of the guidelines, we don't think about just the impact of the guidelines in the US on things like SEP 1. We think about trying to have sort of helpful guidelines that are applicable everywhere. And this issue about the performance measurement is very US-centric, right? This is not something that comes up from any of the other, you know, many societies that sponsor the guidelines, have panelists on the guidelines, and review the guidelines, right? So there was 25 sponsoring organizations that were invited to have a panelist on the guidelines. And these guidelines go out to each of those societies, and they have the ability to, you know, provide comments. And we, you know, make changes in response to those comments. And we provide like a written point by point, you know, response to their comments, just like you would if you had like a paper peer reviewed. And so, again, like this issue comes up really only in the US. And so to me, this, you know, I think that there's kind of two issues at hand. One, there's what the guideline says. And number two, there's how you take the guideline and you translate that to performance measures. And what I think people really have a concern with is how the guideline is translated into performance measures. And I don't think it like helps the global world treat sepsis if you then take that anger over how this is translated into performance measurement and say, oh, we should just say there's no timeline, there's no targets, kind of do whatever you want. I think that will do more global harm. I think our obligation here is to review the evidence and to make the best, you know, clinical guidance we can. You know, I think it can, it's hard to do one-to-one translation of a clinical guideline into a performance measure.
Yeah, I mean, I could see both ways. You could say, well, it's like being an arms dealer or something. You have a responsibility for how your tools are used. But like you said, if it's a very specific problem to one area and you're trying to say things that are more broad for the world, then to what extent can you worry about how it's applied in Bangladesh and Australia and also the U.S.?
Yeah, sorry. My brain is like exploding because I don't like this arms deal metaphor. I think fundamentally the guidelines are designed to do good, right? And sometimes things that are designed to do good, you know, don't do 100% good or they get abused. But like this, the arms are not designed to do good.
What would you say to people who say part of the problem is the specificity? And I don't think that there is, you know, strong enough evidence to say, well, everyone, maybe many septic patients should have some fluid, but they should all have 30 cc's per kilo. So if there's not good reason to say such specific things, then don't say such specific things, because the specificity is how they end up hurting us.
Well, so I guess I would say that, first of all, this is a conditional recommendation, which again says should be done for most patients, but, you know, should consider the clinical context. So again, not a strong recommendation, not saying to do 100% of the time. And then there are also multiple new remarks, right, that have been added to this suggestion for 30 mLs per kg of fluid. Consideration should be given to individual patient characteristics and contexts when selecting initial fluid volume. Clinicians prescribing fluids should perform frequent ongoing reassessment, closely monitor patients to avoid harms of under and over resuscitation. And then if you read the narrative for that recommendation, it talks about how this differs from the European Society of Intensive Care Medicine guidelines on fluid, which say give up to 30 mLs per kg and then transition to personalized fluid resuscitation based on assessment of fluid responsiveness. And so in the narrative, we say, like, you know, what are the differences between why we have, you know, give 30 and they have give up to 30? And I think the difference is that we feel like this is the default practice. This is well tolerated and beneficial to the vast majority of patients who meet the, you know, PICO stem, right, who have sepsis-induced hypoperfusion or septic shock. But it doesn't mean 100%. It doesn't mean all. And it specifically says, if this is a patient where you are more concerned, you can transition sooner to personalized resuscitation. And we do have suggestion for, you know, personalized ongoing resuscitation based on fluid responsiveness assessment. But to sort of say that you're going to personalize from the steps, like step one, you know, the first moment someone gets into the emergency department, that requires a lot more resources, right? Like to do that, it's more labor intensive from staff. You know, a lot of times if you're, you know, depending on what devices you're using, it's also more costly from like just like the, you know, physical resources to do those assessments. And so for us, this is the sort of, you know, reasonable standard default approach. And, you know, when you want to provide guidance, like to provide helpful guidance, you need to be specific, not like, oh, you know, give them some fluid, see what happens, you know. So again, I think that this is an issue of translating clinical guidelines into performance measure, and our like mission as guidelines is to provide helpful and useful clinical guidance and try to be as transparent as possible about when it's a strong recommendation, when it's a conditional recommendation, to include these remarks to, you know, explain again, this is not something we are saying for 100% of the time. And then again, more detail in the narrative about how, again, if you are more concerned that your particular patient won't tolerate fluids, you can transition sooner to this personalized resuscitation. And again, we have, you know, conditional recommendations to use, dynamic measures to assess fluid responsiveness and guide resuscitation. So,
yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people complaining perhaps didn't actually read and see how soft some of the statements are. And also, I mean, to be frank, I think people just, some of the people complaining about this stuff are, they're like experts who have a very nuanced approach to some physiology and probably chafe at any broad statements. And like we said, it's kind of not for them. This is for like the sepsis protocol for the non-expert. If you're in there like ultrasounding 19 parts of the body and you're like, no, this patient should have 1,100 cc, whatever. But most patients, and I do think this, most patients probably benefit or not harmed by a couple liters of fluid. So yeah. this is sort of, I think it is almost more of a psychological stressor because of how people have been hurt by how it was applied than it is a physiologic complaint.
Correct.
And that applies to some of these other things.
And we do have a new table that tells exactly what this volume is. So you're right, like these are not huge volumes. It's sort of like two-ish, 2.5 liters, right? You know, depends on your patient's size, but it's not.
Well, and so I would sort of say, as we're having this discussion, my first thought I'm going to is ACLS, just as an example, right? And so I deviate from ACLS all the time when I run codes. And I get pushback, particularly on the floor, from the floor nurses and ACLS says to do this. No, I know, but if you also look, ACLS says seek expert consultation, and I'm an expert at this. So I think ACLS is written for somebody goes down on the floor and there's not someone who's an expert at cardio resuscitation, what do I do? Oh my gosh, you start doing this. And when somebody shows up who knows what they're doing, they'll take over. And this is sort of the same thing. Like Brandon said, this is a broad guideline and it's written for, you know, somebody comes in who looks like they're in septic shock. Well, what should I do? You start doing this. And if you are an expert or when the expert shows up, they can deviate from this, right? Again, it's a guideline. It's not a fundamental law of nature. And yeah, I agree. I think a lot of the controversy, I'll put scare quotes around controversy, is stemming from one, people who feel like they're being told that they're wrong, even though they're experts, which I don't think is the case. And two, they're kind of mad at the wrong people because they're mad at the guidelines versus what they're really mad at is, well, if I don't follow these guidelines, I don't get paid. And that's not really the guidelines' fault.
Well, and I get the point that no one's coming to penalize you for deviating from ACLS. So we're sort of not the ones in the crosshairs for some of this. But
Yeah. I mean, I will say, right, like there are other emergency medicine societies, right? Society of Academic Emergency Medicine, you know, Europe Society, Asia Society, African Society, they all endorse the guidelines. So I do think that this is an issue of frustration over translation to performance measurement.
Now, I guess connected to that is kind of the question of when you think evidence supports making a recommendation versus not. And I think some people find that it's a little confusing or inconsistent when you say, oh, we're not sure, versus we say, well, we're not sure, but maybe do this way. For example, I noticed that you suggest using epinephrine as a second line presser after norepinephrine and vasopressin. I guess that's a third line presser. Acknowledging there's not a lot of evidence, but methylene blue, you make no recommendation. So, you know, these are the sorts of things I think people are like, well, this is just sort of weird. Like if there's either evidence or there's not, why, how do you kind of make these decisions?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you touch on one, methylene blue, where we sort of had hours and hours and hours of discussion. It's really hard to make those decisions, right? Like, on the one hand, you know, you don't want to elevate sort of what is like limited evidence into a recommendation. On the flip side, sort of providing a statement of no recommendation, you know, really provides very little help. You know, ultimately, this is after many hours of conversation and many discussions of just whether we think that the sufficiency of evidence is kind of enough.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, like you're saying, at the end of the day, you're either going to say something that is some people might disagree with or say nothing. And maybe sometimes saying nothing is the right thing, but if you say enough of nothing, then you haven't achieved anything. And
correct,
probably some
yeah.
people would say, all right, then don't achieve anything. But
yeah. And yeah, the methylene blue is just so interesting too. Yeah. I mean, that we did it in our practice statement on methylene blue. And I will say that the use of methylene blue is very variable, as I understand it, across the world. And that really has to do with what other therapies do you have available, right? Because there's places in the world where they have very few vasopressors, right? So there's not the opportunity for second and third line vasopressors. And then there's more use of methylene blue. And then there's other regions of the world where, well, gosh, we've got like five and six vasopressors at our disposal. And so there's like essentially no use. And so I think that adds an additional challenge, is just that it differs, again, depending on the context. But I think we have a remark about the methylene blue about, you know, again, it may be worth a trial or something like that.
Right.
And we do provide this, you know, panel survey and provide the narrative. So again, like, we're always trying to provide guidance wherever feasible, but not kind of overstep, basically.
Yeah.
You know,
I was also interested to see that it seems like there's some move away from the measurement of lactate. It only seems like that you suggest maybe even checking a lactate and then recommend basically maybe trending it, but not necessarily trying to normalize it, meaning measure what it is, but don't try to give fluids or anything else to make it go away, which I think is probably physiologically correct. But I guess it does raise the question of why measure it if it, like, what should people do with that number?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's helpful. But we also, it's a sort of one data point, you know, and I think it's a helpful data point, but you can't like overly anchor on it. And so I think that, you know, yes, it's helpful. Yes, I want to know if my patient's lactate is going up or it's not, it's high and it's not normalizing. But it's not necessarily a knee-jerk reaction, and therefore I should just keep giving more and more and more fluid, right? So that's kind of, I think, the general balance that we were trying to land there.
Right. And that is a move, because some people in the past were still trying to make the lactate normal by giving boluses.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's one of those things, everybody wants something simple. And unfortunately, this is, lots of medicine is not simple, but this is, I think, an example of the least simple thing that you can do in critical care, or probably in all of medicine, right? There is no, I send a test and it tells me X and then I do Y, right? It's just doesn't work that way.
Yes.
And, you know, and so, yeah, I'll send lactates on people and come back, well, the lactate's still high. Well, maybe I should give more fluid, but I don't say, well, the lactate's 4, so I'm going to give a liter of fluid and then I'm going to check it again in an hour. And if it's still 4, I'm going to give another liter of fluid, right? It's like you said, it's one data point. And I think that's something else that probably adds to the controversy of any kind of guideline like this, is this is a very complex, very fluid situation, and each patient is going to have to be taken somewhat individually, but yet we have to have some sort of overarching document that says in broad strokes this is what we should do. Because if we're just going to say, well, take every patient individually and don't have big overarching guidelines, then, well, let's just shut the doors of medical schools and nursing schools, and, you know, why teach anything in broad strokes if we're just going to say everything is individual?
Well, I do think there's a case you could make there that sepsis as a disease and as a label is so broad. I mean, it's so common because it is so many diseases, mm-hmm. that it to say something broad about sepsis requires you to be very general. You have to boil it down to what's a common denominator. And that's probably part of the reason why it's hard to say more things that are definitive, that there's evidence for, that apply in every situation, and why so often you have to say less. So maybe some people would say, let's just stop talking so much about this disease as a disease, and then you can talk more specifically about some more specific diseases within this umbrella. And then you mm-hmm. could be more specific, more definitive about those things, and more targeted. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, clearly that's where things need to go. I mean, I think that You know, think about like sort of phases of treatment, right? Like think about cancer, right? You know, sort of broad cytotoxic chemotherapy, and then it moved to like less toxic chemotherapy, and now we're in this very like personalized precision medicine. I still think that we are, you know, where is the field of sepsis? We're still in this, we're trying to refine and make our sort of broad treatments less toxic, like don't fluid overload, don't give overly broad antibiotics, right? But I think that we're not going to be able to have sort of personalized precision medicine type guidelines until we have evidence, right? Otherwise, you're going to get like a whole lot of statements of insufficient, you know, evidence. But I think, you know, that's where the field is trying to go, right? Is to try to, you know, essentially phenotype sepsis, you know, check specific markers, trying to understand what are the treatable traits, what are the, you know, things that might warrant like a specific therapy. But I think that the guidelines, you know, are going to depend on that data being available to be able to recommend such approaches.
Yeah. And I think when people are expecting more from a critical care guideline, I think they may not have thought through what they're asking for. Critical care is generally an evidence-sparse realm because it's hard to do studies in these patients. And so if you open a guideline and you expect to see a lot of new things that will change your practice that are clear recommendations, where would those come from? It would have to be some huge gap between what you already knew and where the evidence was. And that means like you've been missing it. Like what's much more likely is there is a lack of evidence, and then you don't want the guideline to say much because they'd be making it up. I mean, they can share some thoughts and practice, but you don't want them to make a statement that is just opinion and is wrong. You want them to say nothing. Or it's saying what you're probably already aware of, because if there was good evidence for it, then you would already be doing. So, you know, in many ways, when these documents don't have much to say, it's just sort of establishing the lack of knowledge in certain areas, you know, pointing out some areas of growth, suggesting some good practices, and making kind of a floor for people who don't already have their own practices and opinions in these areas. That's sort of critical care. And in many ways, it's the problem of critical care that we don't have more data there. I mean, hopefully that will change. But again, we wouldn't want you guys to be making up a whole lot of stuff that goes beyond the evidence.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, science is sort of incremental and you sort of chip away and you refine. But yeah, right. It would be very odd to have a guideline that suddenly, oh, wait, that's completely different than what I had ever thought. Like, well, these are all based on the studies that everybody's already, you know, reading.
One other thing I noticed was a recommendation for prolonged infusion of beta-lactam antibiotics,
yes,
which is also something that's been around the literature, but I think also not a very common practice. This would be like long-term or even like 24-hour drips of antibiotics, which many places will just give quick boluses. This sounds like that you guys think the evidence is there that this could be widely implemented.
Yeah, right. So this, I will clarify, this is for ongoing. So the first dose should still be a quick infusion to get that initial dose into people. But for ongoing maintenance after the initial loading dose, recommendation for prolonged infusion. Why did this get a strong recommendation? So I'm just looking this up. So systematic and review and meta-analysis included 18 randomized clinical trials, over 9,000 participants, and showed that there was high certainty for mortality reduction, 25 fewer deaths per 1,000 patients. When you have sort of high quality data telling you you improve, like what probably the most important outcome that's ever prioritized, and then that's kind of how you end up with a strong recommendation.
The other two things that I think may interest some people, as you mentioned earlier, targeting a MAP of just over 60 in patients who are older, over 65, which I think some people saw the, 60-something trial a few years ago. And I think some people are doing that anyway, but that is sort of useful for a lot of people's practice. And I was also interested that you recommend if the final cultures are negative in a suspected septic patient, you can probably de-escalate or stop antimicrobials, which it's found sort of interesting because it is not a minority of seemingly septic patients, who we never grow anything. And it sounds like you think in those cases we can stop treating them. Now, it'll probably be 4 or 5 days until your cultures are negative. So you have treated them for a while. It's not like they never got anything. But I mean, do you just think that the chance of infection of, you know, active significant infection is low enough if you couldn't grow anything that whatever they've had already is probably enough? Some of them weren't septic. Some were a little septic, but you treated it.
Well, yeah. So, right. Again, they're guidelines and you sort of need to take the clinical context here. And I think, so there's de-escalation, which includes like narrowing the antibiotics and then sort of, you know, cessation altogether. So we've had a number of recommendations kind of historically about, you know, duration of therapy should be tailored, you know, to the clinical course, you know, suggestion to use procalcitonin to help with that for the de-escalation piece, you know, reassess antibiotics every day. And so this is really saying like, right, if you have a patient on very broad spectrum coverage, like covering, you know, Pseudomonas and MRSA, and like you're not growing these things, like you should be decreasing the amount of therapy. And that could mean stopping altogether, then they're on no therapy. That's definitely de-escalation. But it could also mean stepping down the, you know what I mean? If you have a very sick patient, you know, you have to take the other sort of things into consideration about sort of your overall certainty at the end of the day that, yeah, they really did have bacterial infection, and the sort of trajectory to determine whether that should be, you know, a staged, like, okay, we're going to go to a narrower spectrum and then off versus just stop altogether.
I wanted to touch real quick on something that I thought was a nice presentation at Congress. Mervin Murr from Johannesburg did a really nice talk on sort of applying these in low and middle income countries. And I'll just extend that to sort of just resource limited environments. Real quick, just touch on, I know it wasn't your talk, but touch a little bit on the recommendations for applying these in areas like that where resources are limited. And then I kind of want to talk about the broader implications of that.
Yeah, I mean, so I would say that we had a very, you know, diverse panel. 38% of all of our panelists either currently or in the past have practiced in a lower middle income country. So there's a lot of experience on the panel in terms of practicing in lower resource settings. We tried to be quite systematic throughout the entire guidelines in the narratives, like at the end of pretty much all the narratives about how this applies in other places of the world. And to do that, you know, we draw on, is there specific evidence, you know, that was published from low resource settings? There was also a Delphi expert panel paper a couple years back about management of sepsis in low resource settings. So we would often kind of elevate recommendations from that or just from the panel's own practice about, you know, well, if you don't have this available, this is a reasonable alternative. Or, you know, this is something you should really try to prioritize kind of regardless of where you are in the world. Yeah, so we really try. And I would say it's really like baked into the process. Like when we go to this evidence to decision framework, you know, we systematically think about the cost effectiveness, and also like equity. So equity, an example of that would be like, okay, if you're recommending higher oxygen targets and you're in a place that only has so much oxygen and you're literally going to run out, if you use higher targets for certain patients, you may run out of oxygen, right? So we think about those, and those are part of the discussion for every single recommendation. So I would say in general, the more resource intensive a therapy is, the sort of higher level of evidence there needs to be to get it into the guidelines. Like we're sort of thinking about both of those things, you know, at the same time.
What else do you want to leave us with on this topic? Everyone who's reading these guidelines and trying to think about how to apply them, what are your parting thoughts?
Yeah, well, it's a massive document, so I'm not expecting a lot of people to read it from like page one to page last. But I will say, like, you know, we tried to make it as sort of user-friendly as possible in the sense that, like, you bold the recommendations, we have remarks, which we try to really elevate key important parts. But I would say in particular for the areas of your interest, you know, I think the narratives do try to really provide more nuance to people to understand kind of where we got, where we did. So anyway, we hope that they are helpful for the field.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on and talking about this with us. And we'll just recommend everyone does go in and read some of the stuff, not just the bullet points, but understanding the nuances involved. But hopefully this has been helpful for folks who don't have a feel for how this process works and maybe haven't seen the nuances. We want to remind folks that this is just all of our personal opinions. We don't recommend any of our, or we don't represent, rather, any of our individual institutions. And this should not be considered as medical advice. It's just general education stuff. So thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.